two pairs of brogans went along the rows. "You ain't going to believe this. Knowing you for a born liar, I most probably won't. Somebody has been fucking my watermelons."
"What?"
"I said somebody has been..." "No. No, hell no. Damn you if you ain't got a warped mind. I'm telling you, I don't want to hear it. Look a here. And here..." They went along the outer row of the melon patch. He stopped to nudge a melon with his toe. Yellow jackets snarled in the seepage. Some were ruined a good time past and lay soft with rot, wrinkled with imminent collapse.
"It does look like it, don't it?"
"I'm telling you, I seen him. I didn't know what the hell was going on when he dropped his drawers. Then when I seen what he was up to, I still didn't believe it. But yonder they lay."
"What you aim to do?"
"Hell, I don't know. It's about too late to do anything. He's damn near screwed the whole patch. I don't see why I couldn't have stuck to just one or a few."
"Well, I guess he takes himself for a lover. Sort of like a sailor in a whorehouse.
I reckon what it was, he didn't take to the idea of getting bit on the head of his pecker by one of them waspers. I suppose he showed good judgment there.
What was he, just a young feller?"
"I don't know about how young he was, but he was as active a feller as I've seen in a good while. Well, I don't reckon he'll be back."
"I don't know.
A man fast as he is ought not to be qualmy about going anywhere as he took a notion, to steal or whatever."
"What if he does come back?"
"I'll catch him if he does.
And then what?"
"Well, I don't know. Be kindly embarrassing now I think about it. I'd get some work out of him is what I'd do. Ought to, I reckon. I don't know."
"You reckon to call the sheriff?
And tell him what?"
They were walking slowly along the rows.
"It's just the damnedest thing I ever heard of. Ain't it you? What are you grinning at? It ain't funny, a thing like that. To me, it ain't."
Once she had moved beyond the shadow of the smokehouse, he could not see her anymore. He could hear the dull chop of the hoe among the withered yard flowers as she progressed with bland patience along the little garden she had planted there, her and the hoe in shadow oblique and thin, and the chop and clink of the shadow blade in the stony ground. Or she came up from the springhouse lugging a shrunken bucket that sprayed thin fans of water from between the slats and left a damp and trampled swath out to the flower beds and back. He sat on the porch with his feet crossed and fashioned knots in weed stems. Finally, it rained. It rained all one afternoon, and at dusk the burnt grass stood in water, and it rained on into the night. By the time he left the house, it had quit, and the sky was clearing, but he would not turn back. He waited and waited at the field's edge, watching the house and listening. From the dark of the corn, they saw him pass, lean and angular, a slavering nightshade among the moon-sprung vines, over the shadowed blue and furrowed summer land. They gripped each other's arm.
"It's him."
"I hope it is. I'd hate to think of there being two of them." Before them in the field there appeared sudden and apparitional, a starkly pale set of legs galvanized out of the night like a pair of white flannel drawers.
"Throw the light to him. He ain't mounted. Throw it to him."
He was standing in the middle of the patch, facing them, blinking, his overalls about his ankles.
"Hold it right there, old buddy. Don't move."
But he did. He caught up the bib of his overalls in both hands and turned to run. The voice called out again. He had the straps clenched in his fist, making for the field's edge. The train bawled twice out there in the darkness.
"Now beg God's mercy to let you. Unnatural."
Finger coiled, blind sight, a shadow. Smooth-choked, oiled pipe pointing judgment and guilt. Done in a burst of flame. Could I call back that skeltering lead? He was lying on the ground with his legs trapped in his overalls, and he was screaming, "Oh, God! Oh, God!" The man still holding the smoking gun stood about him like a harried bird. The blood oozing from that tender, puckered skin in the gray moonlight undid him.
"Shit," he said. "Oh, shit."
He knelt, flinging the gun away from him. The other man picked it up and stood by.
"Hush now," he said. "God damn, hush!"
Lights from the house limn them and their sorry tableau. The boy is rolling in the rich, damp earth, screaming, and the man keeps saying for him to hush, kneeling there, not touching him. The deputy held the car door, and he climbed out, and they entered a building of solid concrete. The first deputy handed Harrogate's papers to a man at a small window. The man looked through the papers and signed them. Harrogate stood in the hall.
"Harrogate," the man said.
"Yes, sir."
He looked him over.
"God damn if you ain't a sad sack," he said. "Walk on down to that door."
Harrogate walked down the corridor to an iron-barred door. The other deputy had emerged from a side door with a cup of coffee. He had his thumb stuck in his belt, and he blew on the coffee and sipped at it. He did not look at Harrogate. After a while, the man came down the hall with a big brass ring of keys. He opened the gate and pointed for Harrogate to enter. He shut the gate behind them and locked it and turned and went up a flight of concrete stairs. There were two men in striped pants and jumpers sitting there smoking. They scooted against the wall to let the man pass. Harrogate had started up the stairs when one of them spoke to him.
"You better not go up there if he ain't said to."
He came back down again. When the man reappeared, he had a young black with him. The black wore stripes, too. The man opened the door to a large cell, and they entered. The black looked at Harrogate and shook his head and went on through to a door at the rear. There was a little window in the wall, and Harrogate could see him in there, thumbing through stacks of clothing on a shelf.
"Strip out of them clothes and take a shower yonder," said the man.
Harrogate looked around. In the center of the room was a stained porcelain trough with a row of dripping taps hung from a pipe. In each corner at the front of the cell was a concrete wall about as high as Harrogate. Behind one wall, there were three toilets, and behind the other, there were two showers. While he was looking at the showers, a dry towel hit him in the back of the head and fell to the floor.
"You better get on some kind of time," the man said.
Harrogate picked up the towel and put it around his neck and undid his shirt and peeled out of it and laid it on a bench by the wall. Then he unbuttoned his trousers and stepped out of them and laid them across the shirt. He looked like a dressed chicken, his skin puckered with the shot wounds, still red and fresh-looking. He raised his shoes each and slid them from his feet without untying the laces. The concrete floor was cold. He crossed to the showers and peered at them, their valves and spouts.
"I ain't going to tell you again," said the man.
"I don't know how," said Harrogate.
The black boy at the window turned his face away. The man looked up at this news with what seemed to be real interest.
"You don't know how to what?" he said.
"How to run a shower."
"What are you, a fucking smartass?"
"No, sir."
"You mean to tell me you ain't never took a shower?"
"I ain't never even seen one."
The man turned and looked back down the hall.
"Hey, George."
"Yeah?"
"Come in here a minute."
A second man looked in.
"What is it?" he said.
"Tell him what you just told me."
"I ain't never even seen one," said Harrogate.
"Seen what?"
"A shower. He don't know how to take a shower."
The second man looked him over.
"Does he know where he shit last?" he said.
"I doubt it."
"It was down at the county jail," said Harrogate.
"I think you got a smartass on your hands."
"I think I got a dumbass is what I got. You see them there handles?
These here?"
"Them there. You turn them and water comes out of that there pipe."
Harrogate stepped into the shower stall and turned the taps. He picked a slab of used soap from a niche in the wall and soaped himself and adjusted the taps, stepping under the shower carefully so as not to wet his hair. When he was done, he turned off the shower and took the towel down from where he'd hung it over the top of the partition and dried himself and crossed the floor to where he'd left his clothes. He had one leg in his trousers when the black spoke to him.
Hold it, little buddy.
He paused on one leg.
Bring them over here.
Harrogate collected his clothes and carried them to the window. The black took them and hung them on a hanger gingerly with two fingers. The man was sorting about behind him.
It's hanging on the nail yonder,
the black said. Harrogate was sitting naked on the bench. The man came out with a long-handled spray gun. He stood up.
Raise your arms.
He did. The man pumped the sprayer and squirted his armpit.
Shoo, said Harrogate. What's that for?
Bugs, said the guard.
Turn around. I ain't got no bugs.
You ain't now, said the man.
He sprayed under the other arm and then gave Harrogate a good spraying over his sparse pubic hair.
Get them crotch crickets, too, he said.
When he was done, he stepped back. Harrogate stood with his arms aloft like a robbery victim.
Damn if you ain't just barely feathered, said the man. How old are you?
18,
said Harrogate.
18.
Yes, sir.
You just did get in under the wire, didn't you?
I reckon.
What's these here?
That's where I shot.
The man looked from his skinny body to his face again.
Shot, eh? He said.
He handed the spray gun through the window to the black, and the black hung the gun back up behind him and pushed a folded set of stripes through the window at Harrogate. Harrogate unfolded the suit and looked at it. He held the shirt in his teeth while he flapped the trousers out and started to step into them.
Ain't you got no underwear? Said the man.
No.
The man shook his head. Harrogate stood on one leg. He took a little hop to capture his balance.
Go on, said the man. If you ain't got any, you ain't got any.
He dressed and stood barefoot. The trousers ran down over his feet and onto the floor, and just his fingertips hung from the sleeves of the jumper. He looked at the black in the window.
Don't look at me, said the black. Them's as small as they come.
Roll them sleeves and pants up. You'll be all right.
Harrogate rolled the sleeves back two turns. The clothes were clean and rough against his skin.
Do I wear my own shoes? He said.
You wear your own shoes.
The smallest prisoner crossed the floor and stepped into his shoes and clattered back to the window. The man looked him over sadly and handed him a blanket.
Let's go, he said.
Harrogate followed him out and up the stairs, shuffling along, a slight limp. At the top of the stairs, they turned down a hall past huge barred cages like the one they'd left. At the end of the hall sat a man at a table reading a magazine. He rose, smiling, and placed the magazine face down on the table. The man was sorting through the keys.
I think they ought to have thrown this one back, Ed. What do you think?
Ed looked at Harrogate and smiled. The man opened the iron door and Harrogate entered alone. A concrete room painted pea green. He walked past the sink, the taps each tied with little tobacco sacks hanging from their mouths. Pale winter light fell through the welded iron windows. The door clanked shut behind him and the guard's footsteps receded in the corridor. With his blanket, he went down the room past rows of iron beds in blocks of four, all painted green, some with sack-like mattresses, some with nothing but the woven bare iron straps that served for springs. He went along the aisle, looking left and right. A few figures lay motionless in the cots he passed. He went to the end of the room and stood on tiptoe and peered out the window. Rolling hills. Stark winter trees. He came back up the aisle and nudged a sleeper by the foot.
Hey,
he said. The man on the pallet opened one eye and looked at Harrogate.
What the fuck do you want? He said.
Where am I supposed to sleep?
The man groaned and closed his eyes. Harrogate waited for him to open them again, but he did not. After a while, he jostled the foot again.
Hey,
he said. The man did not open his eyes. He said,
if you don't get the fuck away from me, I'm going to kick the shit out of you.
I just wanted to know where I'm supposed to sleep.
Anywhere you like, you squirrely son of a bitch. Now get the hell away from here.
Harrogate wandered on up the aisle. Some of the bunks had pillows as well as blankets. He picked one out that had only a bare tick and climbed up and spread his blanket and sat in the middle of it. He sat there for a while, and then he climbed down again and went to the bars and peered out. Someone in a suit like his was coming backward down the hallway, towing a bucket on wheels by a mop submerged in the black froth it held. He glanced at Harrogate as he went past, a cigarette in the corner of his mouth. He didn't look friendly. Across the hall, another prisoner was peering from his cage. Harrogate studied him for a minute. Then he gave sort of a crazy little wave at him.
"Howdy,"
he said.
"Sure," said the other prisoner.
Harrogate turned and went back and climbed into his bunk and lay staring at the ceiling. Concrete beams painted green. A few half-blackened light bulbs screwed into the masonry. It had grown dim within the room, the early winter twilight closing down the day. He slept. When he woke, it was dark out, and the bulbs in the ceiling suffused the room with a sulphurous light. Harrogate sat up. Men were filing into the cell with a sort of constrained rowdiness, not quite jostling one another, lighting or rolling cigarettes, speaking only once they were inside, a rising exchange of repartee and shaded insult. One spied Harrogate, where he sat up in his cot like a ground squirrel, and pointed him out.
"Looky here, new blood!"
They filed past. Toward the end came men hobbling with what looked like the heads of pickaxes welded about one ankle. The door clanged, keys rattled. Two men turned in at the bunks beneath Harrogate. One of them lay down and closed his eyes for a minute, and then sat up and shucked off his shoes and lay back and closed his eyes again. The other stood with his head bent a few inches from Harrogate's knee and began to unload his pockets of various things. A pencil stub, matchbooks, a beer can opener, a flat black stone, a sack of tobacco. He saw Harrogate watching him and looked up. "Hey," he said.
"Hey,"
said Harrogate. "You don't piss in the bed, do you?"
"No, sir."
"You smoke?"
"I used to some, before I got throwed in the jailhouse and couldn't get nary."
"Here." He pitched the sack of tobacco up onto Harrogate's blanket. Harrogate immediately opened the sack and took a paper from the little pocket under the label and began to roll a cigarette. "You get one of those every week," the man said.
"When do I get mine?"
"Next week."
"You ain't got no match, have you?"
"Here." Harrogate lit the cigarette and sucked deeply and blew out the match and put it in his cuff. "Keep 'em." He put the matches in his pocket. "How old are you?"
18.
18?
"Yes, sir."
"You just made it, didn't you?"
"That's what they keep telling me."
"What's your name?"
"Gene Harrogate."
"Harrogate," the man said. He had one elbow on the upper bunk and was holding his chin in his fingers, studying the new prisoner with a rather detached air. "Well," he said, "my name's Sutry."
"Howdy, Mr. Sutry."
"Just Sutry. What are you in for?"
"Stealing watermelons."
"That's bullshit. What are you in for?"
"I got caught in a watermelon patch."
"With what? A tractor and trailer? They don't send people to the workhouse for stealing a few watermelons. What else did you do?" Harrogate sucked on his cigarette and looked at the green walls.
"Well," he said, "I got shot."
"Got shot?"
"Yeah."
"Whereabouts?" "Yeah, I know. In the watermelon patch. Where did you get hit?"
"Pretty near all over."
"What with, a shotgun?"
"Yeah."
"For stealing watermelons?"
"Yeah."
Sutry sat down on the lower bunk and put one foot up and began to rub his ankle. After a while, he looked up. Harrogate was lying on his stomach, looking down over the edge of his bunk. "Let's see where you got shot," said Sutry. Harrogate knelt up in the bed and lifted his jumper. Little mauve tucks in his pale flesh all down the side of him like pox scars.
"I got 'em all down my leg, too. I still can't walk good."
Sutry looked up at the boy's eyes. Bright with a kind of animal cognizance, with incipient goodwill. "Well," he said, "it's getting rough out there, isn't it?"
Boy, I thought I was dead.
I guess you're lucky you're not.
That's what they said at the hospital.
Sutry leaned back in his bunk. What kind of son of a bitch would shoot somebody for stealing a few watermelons, he said.
I don't know. He come out to the hospital and brung me a ice cream. I didn't much blame him. He said hisself he wished he'd not done it.
Didn't keep him from pressing charges, though, did it?
Well, I guess, seeing as he'd done shot me, he couldn't back out.
Sutry looked at the boy again with this remark, but the boy's face was bland and without device. He wanted to know when supper was served. 5 o'clock. Should be in a few minutes.
Do they feed good?
You'll have time to get used to it. What did you draw, anyway?
1129.
Old 1129.
Boy, they feed good in that hospital. Best you ever ate.
Couldn't you have run off from there?
I never had no clothes. I thought about it, but I didn't have stitch one, nor no way to come by any. I'd rather to be in the workhouse than get caught out wearing one of them old crazy nightshirts they make you wear. Wouldn't you?
No.
Well, that's you.
That's me. Harrogate looked down at him, but he had his eyes closed. He rolled back over and stared at the ceiling. Someone had written a few sentiments there, but they were lost in the glare of the light bulbs. After a while, he heard a bell clang somewhere. A guard came to the door and opened it, and when Harrogate sat up, he saw that the prisoners were shaping up, ready to leave, and he hopped from the bunk and shaped up with them. They marched down the concrete stairs and turned through a door and filed through a mess hall where picnic tables ran the length of the room. They were cobbled up out of oak flooring and had the benches bolted to them. At the end of the mess hall, the prisoners turned into the kitchen where each man got a tin plate and a large spoon. They filed past a steam table where the kitchen help likewise in stripes, ladled up smoking pinto beans, cabbage, potatoes, hot rounds of cornbread. Harrogate had his thumb in his plate and got hot cabbage spooned over it by a smiling black man. He said, "Yow!" swapped hands and stuck the thumb in his mouth. A guard came over and looked down at him. "Was that you?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"One more holler out of you and you get no supper."
"Yes, sir."
Nearby, prisoners wore pinched faces, apparently in pain, eyes half shut with joy constrained. Harrogate followed on into a mess hall like the one they'd come through. The benches and tables were filling up with prisoners. He sought out Sutry and sat next to him and fell to with his spoon. A great clanking and scraping throughout the hall, and no word spoke. The table across from them was taken by black prisoners, and Harrogate eyed them narrowly from under his brows, his head bent over his plate and the spoon he gripped like a trowel, rising and falling woodenly. When his group had all done eating, the guard walked along behind them to the head of the table and rapped, and they rose and filed back through the kitchen, scraping their plates into a slop can and stacking them on a table, dropping their spoons into a bucket. Then they filed out through the other mess hall, now partly filled with prisoners eating, and into the hall and up the stairs to their cell again.
"There wasn't no meat," said Harrogate.
"That's right," said Sutry.
"Do they ever have meat?"
"I don't know."
"Have you ever eaten any meat here?"
"You mean other than breakfast bacon?"
"Yeah, other than breakfast bacon."
"No." Harrogate leaned against the bunk. After a while, he said,
"How long you been here?"
"About 5 months."
"The hellfire," said Harrogate.
It was dark when they rose in the morning, and dark when they filed into the kitchen to get their plates and spoons, and still dark when they turned out into the dewfall and grainy mist of the yard. He stood there with his sleeves and cuffs rolled 2 turns each and watched the men climb into the trucks. He looked for Sutry, but by the time he saw him, he was already in a truck and the door was shut. Some of the trucks started to pull away. A guard came over and looked down at him. He stooped with his hands on knees to see into his face.
"Who the hell are you?" he said. "Harrogate."
The guard nodded his head as if this was the right answer.
"Did you get your breakfast?" "Sure did."
"If
Feel like you're ready for a day's work, do you?
I reckon.
Well, we have a truck over here for you to ride in, if that's all right with you.
This in here?
Yeah. You don't care, do you? Harrogate grinned.
Shoot, he said. I reckon that's what all I'm here for. I'd do just whatever.
Well, we're mighty pleased about that.
We like for everybody to be happy.
Shoot, said Harrogate over his shoulder as he slouched toward the waiting truck.
I ain't hard to get along with.
As he reached the rear of the truck and put up one hand to help himself, the guard fetched him a kick from behind that lifted him through the door and dropped him among the boots and shoes of the other prisoners. They looked down at him with crazed grins, and someone jerked him forward by the collar in time to keep the door from slamming on his foot. A red-headed man leaned down and said,
"Get in here, idiot. You make that son of a bitch mad this early of the morning, and I'll kick your ass myself."
I didn't know which truck I was supposed to go to.
Well, no truck was the wrong one. Set over here. This son of a bitch drives like a drunk Indian going after more whiskey.
The truck coughed up gouts of white smoke, and they lurched off into the fog, down the hill and down the winding workhouse road to the highway where the taillights of the other trucks went by twos like eyes before them in the cool October dawn. The prisoners sat in rows facing each other, jiggling and rolling, some trying to sleep. Harrogate crouched on the bench with his hands beneath his thin legs and watched the floor. There was no conversation. The truck gained speed and the tires sang on the black road. At the first stoplight, a young girl was waiting for a bus at the edge of the road. The prisoners shoved and crowded at the wire mesh door of the truck. She turned to stare out over the barren lots toward houses swimming in the mist. A cold light was leaking across the landscape from the east. Harrogate watched two birds come out of the colorless heavens and alight upon a wire and look down into the truck and fly again. They went on, the driver's eyes in a car come up behind them, somewhat uneasy at the sight of these striped miscreants. By good daylight, they had crossed the north end of the county and were pulled up at a roadside where a sewer pipe lay unjointed along a selvage of red mud, and where riders from the first truck had already descended into ditches and begun to swing picks. The sun rose and warmed them where they stood waiting tools and orders. A man handed Harrogate a pick, stepped back and studied him with it, and took it away again. A few cars eased past, faces at the glass, men bound for work in the city looking out with no expression at all. The prisoners shuffled and milled about until all had tools and Harrogate stood alone. He had started down into the ditch with naked hands when a guard called to him.
"Wait here a minute," he said.
The guard went away and returned with another man who looked down at Harrogate suspiciously.
"How old are you, son?"
"I'm still 18," said Harrogate.
He had one black tooth in the front of his mouth, and he sucked at it nervously. The two men looked at each other. The younger one shrugged.
"I don't know," he said. "Well, hell. Take him on back and let Coatney have him. You go on back with Mr. Williams, you hear?"
"Yes, sir."
"Get in that pickup over yonder and wait," the other man said.
Harrogate nodded and hobbled up the road to the truck and climbed up into the bed and sat there in his outsized togs watching the men in the ditch. He saw Sutry shoveling dirt up over the rim of the excavation, and Sutry looked his way once, sitting there alone in the truck, but he did not nod or gesture. After a while, the guard came up. He motioned to him and opened the door of the truck.
"Get up front," he said.
Harrogate climbed over the side of the truck and opened the door and got in. There was a speaker hanging by a cord from the dashboard, and there was a pump-action shotgun hung in a rack over the rear window. The guard started the truck, glanced down at Harrogate, and pulled away, shaking his head. When Sutry came in that night, the smallest prisoner was not in the cell. He saw him at supper, half obscured behind tottering tiers of pans, smoking a home-rolled cigarette and firing thin pipes of smoke from his nostrils in disgust. He was moved that night to the kitchen cell. When he came to get his blanket, Sutry was lying stretched on his cot with his shoes off. His socks were streaked with red clay.
"Guess what?" said Harrogate.
"What?"
"They got me washing fucking dishes."
"I know. I saw you." Shit, said Harrogate.
Hell, that's no bad shake. It beats swinging a pick all day.
It don't to me. I'd rather do anything as to wash dishes.
You'll appreciate it more when the weather turns colder.
Shit.
Harrogate gathered up his blanket in his arms. Someone down the cell called up to Sutry as he threw with the newspaper.
Yeah, said Sutry. Come and get it.
Fold it and pitch it here.
Sutry folded the paper and tried to remember how you tucked them in for throwing.
God damn, Sutry. Was you not ever a paper boy?
No.
I guess you was on a allowance.
The man had turned out of his cot and come up the hall.
I used to know how to roll them, but I've forgotten. Here, let me have it. Fucking educated piss willies. He goes to college, but he can't roll a newspaper. What do you think of that, little buddy?
The man was standing alongside the bunk. Red-headed, freckled, pumpkin-toothed. The nose he talked through spread all over his face.
Howdy, Mr. Callahan, said Harrogate.
Sutry poked his head out from under the bunk.
Mr. Callahan, he said. You heard him.
Oh, boy, said Sutry, lying back down. Callahan grinned his gap-tooth grin.
Mr. Callahan's got a lot of pull around here, said Sutry.
Ask him if he can do something for you. Do what?
He wants to get out of the kitchen. He thinks washing dishes is beneath his dignity.
Hellfire, little buddy. You got the best job in the joint. I don't like it, said Harrogate sullenly. They got me working with a bunch of old cripple fuckers, and I don't know what all.
Especially in the guards' mess, said Callahan.
Guards' mess? God damn, said Sutry.
That's what they promised him, said Callahan. I guess he don't like steak and gravy, ham, eggs every morning. Shit, said Harrogate.
It's true, said Sutry.
Hell, Sutry, I don't want to be no goddamn dishwasher. I got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, we sleep in here till 5:30.
You get to fuck around in the afternoon, said Callahan. Well, we don't get done till 7 at night.
Well, if you don't want to work in the guards' mess, ask if they'll put you back on the trucks.
What if they say no?
Say yes.
What happens then? I guess they beat the shit out of you.
No, they won't. Will they, Red?
Nah. Put you in the hole,
unless you get real shitty. Then you go in the box.
Well, that's where they'd put me. What is it?
Just a concrete box about 4 feet square.
You ever been in there, Sutry?
No. You're talking to a man that has, though.
What do they put you in there for, Mr. Callahan?
Oh, slapping a little old guard.
He slapped a vertebra loose in his neck, said Sutry.
God damn, said Harrogate. When was this?
When was it, Red? 2 years ago? Something like that.
The hellfire. How long you been in here, Mr. Callahan?
That was another offense, said Sutry. He's been in and out. They don't give you nothing to eat but bread and water, said Callahan. In the box, they don't. I believe you'll like the guards' mess better than the box.
I ain't washing no more goddamn dishes.
Well, said Sutry, that's you.
That's me, said Harrogate.
I think you've lost your rabbit-assed mind, said Callahan.
Maybe, but I tell you one thing. I ever get out of here, I sure to shit ain't coming back again.
I think I even heard Bromo say that one time.
Who's Bromo?
The old guy. He's been in and out of here since 1936.
He was in for that, said Callahan. He was in the other workhouse before this one was built. Well,
said Harrogate,
that's him.
Sutry grinned.
That's him, he said.
The crimes of the Moonlight Melon Mounter followed him as crimes will. Truth of his doings came in at the door and up the stairs in the dark. Come morning, the prisoners were seeing this half-fool in a new light. To his elbows in dishwater and wreathed in steam, he watched them file across the kitchen with their plates of biscuits and gravy, nodding, gesturing. He smiled back. They saw him again that night, lost in his stained and shapeless suit. He appeared not to have moved the day long, nor the stacked pans diminished. After supper, he was returned to them, clutching his blanket before him. "Well," said Sutri, "you back?"
"Yep."
"What happened?"
"I told them I was done fucking with them. They want a dishwasher, they can hunt somebody else, 'cause I ain't it."
"What did they say?"
"They asked me did I want to be hall boy. Said you make a few dollars selling coffee."
"A few dollars a year?"
"That's just what I figured. I told them I didn't want no hall boy bullshit."
"So what happened?"
"Nothing. They just sent me on up."
He stood there with his rat's face in a kind of smug smirk. Sutri shook his head.
"Yonder he is," called Callahan.
"Watermelon man."
"Pumpkins, wasn't it?"
"Pumpkins? God almighty."
"Yeah," sang out Callahan. "We get out, we going to open a combination fruit stand and whorehouse."
Harrogate smiled nervously. Callahan was sketching for them a portrait of his brothel.
"Melons in black negligees. Watch out the niggers don't hear of it. The niggers is liable to lynch you."
Other fruits discussed. A cantaloupe turned queer. "Do you buy them a drink?"
"Worst of it is having gnats swarm around the head of your dick. Fruit flies."
"Stealing watermelons, eh?" said Sutri. Harrogate grinned uneasily.
"They tried to get me for bestiality. Yeah, but my lawyer told them a watermelon wasn't no beast. He was a smart son of a bitch."
"Oh, boy," said Sutri. In the morning, he went with them on the trucks, rising in the rank cold, faint odor of bathless sleepers all about. People stirring in the dull yellow bulb light, stumbling into clothes and shoes. The warmth of the kitchen and the smell of coffee. Cooks and pot washers, aged or maimed, all hovered by the stove with hot crockery mugs in their hands. Harrogate nodded to them distantly, holding his thumbs wide of his plate. In the long days of fall, they went like dreamers, watching the sky for rain. When it came, it rained for days. They sat in groups and watched the rain fall over the deserted fairgrounds. Pools of mud and dark sawdust and wet-trodden papers, the painted canvas funhouse walls and the stark skeletons of amusement rides against a gray and barren sky. A sad and bitter season, barrenness of heart and gothic loneliness. Sutri dreamed old dreams of fairgrounds where young girls with flowered hair and wide child's eyes watched by flare lights sequined aerialists aloft. Visions of unspeakable loveliness from a world lost, to make you ache with want. In the afternoon, the riggers came and set about taking down a spider-like centrifuge and loading it on a float. As the prisoners shuffled over the grounds, filling their croaker sacks with bottles and trash, the workers backhanded to them packs of cigarettes. Sutri was given a pack and passed it on to an old man with a goiter who took it without a word. The old man was a smokehound, a drinker of shaving lotion, stove fuel, cleaning fluid. Sutri watched him shuffle on, scowling at the world from under his wild, thatched brows, his thin and wrinkled mouth working very faintly as he spoke with himself. He took up each paper, each bottle, with something like solicitude, looking about as if he would discover who had put it there. Sutri never heard him speak aloud, this elder child of sorrow. He crouched on the truck bench opposite going home, jostled and nodding. He saw Sutri watching him and lowered his eyes and fell to talking to himself with a kind of secretive viciousness. Sundays, a female evangelist from Knoxville would come out to hold service in the chapel downstairs. Concrete tabernacle, small wooden podium. The prisoners who went seemed stricken nigh insensate by this word of God, strained distaff they were hearing. Lounging in the wooden folding chairs, heads lolling. She seemed unaware of their presence. She told old tales from Bible days that might have come down orally, so altered were they from their origins. In the afternoon, visitors arrived. Family scenes, mothers and fathers, wives, anonymous kinfolk gathered at the long tables in the dining hall. They'd call the names back down the hall and up the stairs, and the guard would let them out. To return, laden with candy, fruit, cigarettes. No one came for Suttree. None for Harrogate. Callahan's friends from McAnally Flats brought brown-looking apples, sacks of half-spoiled oranges. Callahan would peel these and slice them into a lard pail and cover them with water, adding a little yeast from the kitchen, covering it over with a cloth and storing it under his bed. In a few days, a yeasty orange wine would work up, and he'd strain it off and invite friends to take a cup with him. They called it julep, and it kicked and spewed in the stomach all night. Callahan would get slightly drunk and look about good-naturedly to see was there thing or body worth destroying. Bird Slusser came back, clumping sullenly down the aisle with his blanket, a pick about his ankle. When the workers returned in the evening, he was asleep, nor did he rise for supper. In these tranquil evening hours, before lights out, Harrogate would sit up in his bunk and work on his jailhouse ring. They were made from silver coins, and Harrogate had gotten a guard to bore a hole in his, and he sat for hours on end with a mess hall spoon and beat the coin's rim. The edges of the piece would flare out and come at last to a shape much like a wedding band. Now, as he sat tapping, Slusser turned in his bunk, raising his leg to clear the rear tine of the pick, and sought out the source of the noise. Harrogate squatted above him in the bunk opposite, bent over his coin, the spoon tapping steadily, much like a little old cobbler crouched there, half lost in his clothes.
"Hey," said Slusser.
Harrogate looked down benignly.
"Heidi," he said.
"Knock off that fucking tapping."
He fixed Harrogate with a fearful look and rolled back over. Harrogate sat with the coin in one hand and the spoon in the other. He looked down at the man. He took a tentative click at the coin rim. Click. He pulled up the blanket from the edge of the bunk and folded it over his hands, muffling the work between his knees. Click, click, click. He looked down at the man. The man lay as before. Click, click, click. Slusser rose from the bunk slowly like a man bored. He came around the end of the bunk and reached his hand up to Harrogate.
"Give me that," he said.
Harrogate clutched the blanket to his chest.
"You little fist fucker, you better hand me that goddamn spoon before I jerk you out of there."
Suttree, who'd been half asleep below, had a feeling sensation in the pit of his stomach. He said,
"Leave him alone, Bird."
The boy's tormentor lost interest in him instantly, and his eyes swung toward Suttree with a schizoid's alacrity.
"Well now," he said, "I didn't know he was yours."
"He's not anybody's.
He's a punk."
"I don't believe he is."
"Maybe you're one yourself."
"Maybe," said Suttree, on whose forehead small beads of sweat had begun to glisten.
"You've been pulling your pud too much."
Slusser reached and seized him by the front of his jumper and dragged him upright. Suttree gripped his arm, coming out onto the floor.
"Turn loose of my shirt, Bird," he said.
Bird twisted the cloth in his fist. There was no sound in the cell. Suttree could see himself twinned in the cool brown eyes, and he didn't like what he saw. He swung at Slusser's face. Immediately a fist crashed against the side of his head. He heard the sea roll. He swung again. His shirt came loose with a loud rip, but he did not hear it. He pushed himself forward, his head ducked, and caromed off the side of the bunk. When he looked up, he could not see Slusser. Some prisoners were standing between him and the hall, and he heard grunts and the meaty sound of fists. Callahan's face went past smiling, beyond the shoulders of the watching men. Suttree elbowed his way through the spectators. The fight crashed into the bunks and went to the wall and back down the cell, Slusser standing flat-footed because of the pick on his ankle, cursing. Callahan smiling. He was backing Slusser down along the wall in the narrow space behind the bunks. In turning between the bunks, Slusser's pick got hung. Callahan stepped forward and slammed him broadside in the head. Slusser lashed out blindly, then kicked out with the pick. It stung a star-shaped pock in the concrete, and Slusser's eyes rolled with pain. He was still trying to kick Callahan with the pick when the iron door swung and two guards rushed in with slapsticks. The first person to get clobbered was a country boy from Brown's Mountain named Lethal King. He sat down on the floor, holding his head with both hands.
"God damn," he said.
Callahan had leaped back, holding up his hands.
"He's gone crazy," he said.
Slusser turned. He looked crazy. Eyes wild, a blue swelling at his temple, giving his face an asymmetrical twist. The prisoners had fallen away. Slusser turned toward the guards in a half-crouch, and they fell upon him with slapsticks flailing. Callahan lowered his hands and leaned forward to see better. The slapsticks were going whop, whop, whop. Slusser on the floor with just the pick sticking out, the guards hammering away from kneeling positions like carpenters on a roof. When they raised him up, he was limp and bleeding from the mouth and ears, and his face was his face seen through bad glass. Lethal had risen from the floor, and Blackburn pointed his cudgel at him and said,
"You, get this man. Callahan, you son of a bitch, you get his other side."
"I ain't done nothing,"
said Lethal, coming forward uncertainly. Callahan already had Slusser's arm draped around his neck and was bearing him up. He wiped a thin trickle of blood from his own mouth with a freckled fist and turned and gave the prisoners a pinched grimace of idiotic triumph which sent such a plague of grins among them that the other guard turned at the door.
"What the hell are you doing, Callahan?"
"Just holding this man up. Where do you want him?"
They followed the guards out the door, and Blackburn slammed the gate and locked it, and they followed them down the hall and down the stairs, Slusser's pick dragging along behind until the other guard fell back and raised it up, and they went on like that, bearing Slusser on toward the box with his hind leg aloft like a wounded ice skater. The guard returned with Lethal and Callahan, and when he unlocked the door, Callahan started through it.
"Hold it, Callahan," said the guard.
Callahan held it. The guard shut the door behind Lethal and locked it and motioned Callahan down the hall. The prisoners could hear him protesting.
"Hellfire, what for? I ain't done a goddamn thing. Hellfire!"
Sutry went back to his bunk, touching his swollen ear with his fingertips. Harrogate was still crouching in the top of his bunk with the spoon in his hand.
"Where are they going with Mr. Callahan?"
he said. "To the hole." Blackburn's wise to his bullshit.
"How long will they keep him in there?"
"I don't know. A week, maybe."
"God damn," said Harrogate.
"We sure stirred up some shit, didn't we?"
Sutry looked at him.
"Gene," he said.
"What?"
"Nothing. Just Gene."
"Yeah? Well?"
"You better hope they keep Slusser in the box."
"What about you?"
"He's already punched me."
"Well, as long as they let Mr. Callahan out before they do him."
Sutry looked at him. He was not lovable. This adenoidal leptosome that crouched above his bed like a wizened bird, his razorous shoulder blades jutting in the thin cloth of his striped shirt. Sly, rat-faced, a convicted pervert of a botanical bent. Who would do worse when in the world again? Bet on it. But something in him so transparent, something vulnerable. As he looked back at Sutry with his almost witless equanimity, his naked face was suddenly taken away in darkness. Some of the prisoners called out, complaining. The hall guard told them to knock it off.
"Hellfire! It ain't but 8 o'clock.
Knock it off in there!"
Bodies undressing in the dark. The hall light made a puppet show of them. Sutry sat on his bunk and eased off his clothes and laid them across the foot of the bed and crawled under the blanket in his underwear. Voices died in the room, rustlings, the light from the yard lamps falling through the windows like a cold blue winter moon that never waned. He was drifting. He could hear a truck's tires on the pike a half mile away. He heard the chair leg squeak in the hall where the guard shifted. He could hear. He leaned out of the bunk.
"I will be goddamned," he said. "Harrogate?"
"Yeah?"
Hoarse whisper in the dark.
"Will you knock off that goddamn clicking?"
There was a brief pause.
Okay, said Harrogate.
When they came in from work the next evening, Harrogate had a couple of small jars he'd found in the roadside. Sutry saw him descend from his bunk after lights out. He seemed to disappear somewhere in the vicinity of the floor. When he reappeared, he camped on the floor at the head of Sutry's bed, and Sutry could hear a tin set down on the concrete and the clink of glass.
What the fuck are you doing? He whispered.
Shh, said Harrogate. He heard liquid pouring.
Phew,
said a voice in the dark. A whiff of rank ferment crossed Sutry's nostrils.
Harrogate?
Yeah?
What are you up to?
Shh,
here.
A hand came toward him from the gloom, offering a jar. Sutry sat up and took it and sniffed and tasted. A thick and sourish wine of unknown origins.
Where'd you get this?
He said.
Shh. It's Mr. Callahan's julep he had working. You reckon it's ready?
If it had been ready, he'd have drunk it.
That's what I thought.
Why don't you put it up and let it work some more, and we'll drink it Saturday night?
You reckon it'll tear your head up?
Sutry reckoned it would tear your head up. They lay there in the dark.
Hey, Sut.
What?
What do you aim to do when you get out?
I don't know.
What was you doing before you got in?
Nothing. Laying drunk. A deep wheezing of sleepers rose and fell about them.
Hey, Sut.
Go to sleep, Gene. By morning, a heavy rain had set in, and they did not go out. They sat in small groups in the dimly lit cell and played cards. It was cold in the room, and some wore their blankets shawled about their shoulders. They looked like detained refugees. At noon, a gimp-legged prisoner brought up sandwiches from the kitchen. Thin slices of rat cheese on thin slices of white bread. The prisoners bought matchboxes of coffee from the hall boy for a nickel, and he poured hot water in their cups. Harrogate came awake from a deep nap and hopped to the floor to get his lunch. He drank plain water with his sandwich, crouched up there in his bunk, his cheeks jammed. Outside, the cold gray winter rain fell across the county. By nightfall, it would turn to snow. He'd finished his sandwiches and was back to tapping at his ring when a new thought changed his face. He put aside his work and climbed down to the floor and crawled under Sutry's bunk. Then he crawled out and back up topside, where he fell to work again. In a little while, he crawled down again. Toward dusk, a few prisoners looked his way to see what went, the smallest prisoner sitting in the top of his bunk, suddenly going, "Hoo, hoo," like a chimpanzee, and lapsing silent again. When the triangle rang for dinner, all fell out save he. Sutry came by from his card game and shook him by the shoulder. "Hey, hotshot, let's go." Harrogate raised up with one eye shut, his face matted where it had lain crushed in the blanket.
"He
said. "Let's go to supper." He swung his legs over the side of the bed and pitched out onto the floor, face down. Sutry had turned to go when he heard the crash. He looked and saw Harrogate struggling in the floor and came back and helped him up.
"What the fuck's wrong with you?"
"Yeesh,"
said Harrogate.
"Shit," said Sutry.
"You better stay here. Can you get back in the bunk?" Harrogate fended him away and focused one eye toward the cell door.
"Sap, sap,"
he said.
"You crazy fucker, you can't even walk."
Harrogate started across the tilted floor, listing badly. The other prisoners were jammed at the door, filing out by twos and down the stairs. Some looked back.
"Look coming here.
What's happened to him?
Looks like one leg's grown longer than the other."
Harrogate crashed into the end of a set of bunks and reeled away.
"Damned if the country mouse ain't drunker than hell. Them eyes look like two piss holes in the snow."
He veered toward them like a misfired android. One caught him up by the sleeve.
"You going to supper, Country Mouse?"
"You fucking A,"
said Country Mouse. They covered for him in line, holding him erect, shielding him from the guards. The cook's helper, who loaded his plate, looked at his face, probably because it was the only one in the line passing at that diminished altitude.
shit a brick, he said.
Bet your ass, said Harrogate, winking profoundly.
They went on to the mess hall. Harrogate stepped over the bench and misbalanced and stepped back. He raised his foot to try again. One of the prisoners grabbed his leg and pulled it down and caught his tilting plate and jerked him into the bench alongside him.
Hee hee,
said Harrogate. Someone kicked him under the table. He peered about at nearby faces for the culprit. The blacks, filing in at the table opposite, seemed to have wind of him already and were ogling and grinning. Harrogate spooned up a load of pinto beans and shoved them toward his jaw. Some fell down the front of him. He looked after them. He began to spoon beans from his lap. Several guards were watching. He was having difficulty sitting on the bench. He was tottering about. The guard at the head of the table, a man named Wilson, walked down to get a better look. Harrogate sensed him standing there above him and turned to see, falling against the prisoner at his side as he did so. Wilson looked down into the thin face, now slightly green. Harrogate turned back to his food, holding on to the edge of the table with one hand.
This man's drunk, said Wilson.
Somewhere down the table, someone muttered no shit, and a ripple of tittering passed through the mess hall. Wilson glared.
All right, he said. Knock it off. You, get up.
Harrogate put down his spoon and took another grip on the table and raised himself up. But since the bench would not push back from the table, he remained in a sort of crouched position, finally losing his balance and sitting down again. Now he turned in his seat and tried to get one foot over the bench, lifting his leg up by the cuff of his trousers, one elbow resting in his food. The clanking and scraping of spoons had ceased altogether. The only sound in the mess hall was Harrogate struggling to free himself from the table, Wilson standing over him like a faith healer over a paraplegic, until he actually raised up astraddle the bench, creamed corn dripping from his sleeve.
Ick, he said.
What?
Said Wilson menacingly. The country mouse closed his eyes, belched, opened them again.
Sick,
he said. He was trying to raise his other leg. The prisoner alongside looked up at him and leaned away. Harrogate lurched and his neck gave a sort of chicken-like jerk, and he vomited on Wilson's shoes. The prisoners on either side of Harrogate leaped up. Wilson's slapstick was out. He was looking at his shoes. He couldn't believe it. Harrogate wore a look of terror. He seized hold of the table, looking about wildly, his gorge swollen. He spied his plate. He leaned toward it. He vomited on the table.
You nasty little bastard, screamed Wilson.
He was doing little kicks, trying to shake the puke from his shoes. The prisoners, who'd been sitting opposite Harrogate, had risen from the table and were watching the country mouse in awe. Harrogate looked up at them with weeping eyes and managed just the smallest black-tooth grin before he puked again. They did not see him for 10 days. Then one morning, as they filed through the kitchen with their plates, there he was, grinning sheepishly, ladling up gravy for their biscuits. Beyond him, through the steam, on a can with a cigarette in his mouth, sat Red Callahan. No one asked where Slusser was. That night, when they came in, he must have been showering in the kitchen cell, because when they went past on their way to their own quarters, silently in twos, exuding the aura of cold they'd brought in with them, Harrogate suddenly appeared naked at the bars, his thin face, his hands clutching like a skinned spider monkey.
Sut, he called out softly. Hey, Sut.
Sutry heard his name. As he came abreast of the smallest prisoner, he dropped out of the line. When will the phantom puker strike again? He said.
What the fuck are you doing? Bear asked.
Listen, Sut, that fucking Wilson's got it in for me. I gotta get out of here.
Out of where?
Here. The joint.
You mean runoff?
Yeah.
Sutry shook his head.
That's crazy, Gene, he said.
I need you to help me.
Sutry fell back in at the tail of the line. You're nuts, Gene, he said. He saw him again a week later on Thursday when he was assigned to the indigent food detail. The needy trooping through in rags, their eyes rheumy, snuffling, showing their papers at the desk and going on to where the prisoners unloaded bags of cornmeal from pallets or scooped dried beans into grocery bags. Sutri sought their eyes, but few looked up. They took their dole and passed on. Old, shapeless women in thin summer dresses, socks collapsed about their pale and naked ankles, shoes opened at the side with knives to ease their feet. The seams of their lower faces stained with snuff, their drawstrung mouths. To Sutri they seemed hardly real, like picture show paupers costumed for a scene. At the noon dinner break, he and Harrogate fell in together. They crouched with others among the palleted beans and unwrapped their sandwiches.
What we got?
Bologna.
Anybody got a cheese?
They ain't no cheese. Sud.
Yeah?
Shh. Do you know where we're at?
Where we're at?
I mean, which way is town?
Harrogate speaking in loud, hoarse whispers, spewing bits of bread. Sutri jerked a thumb over his shoulders.
It's that way, he said.
Harrogate motioned his thumb down and looked about.
What I figure to do, he said.
Gene.
Yeah?
If you run off from here, you'll wind up like Slusser.
You mean with a pick on my leg?
I mean you'll be in and out of institutions for the rest of your life.
Save for one thing.
What's that?
They ain't going to catch me.
Where will you go?
Go to Knoxville.
Knoxville?
Hell yes.
What makes you think they won't find you in Knoxville?
Hellfire, Sut. Bigger place as Knoxville is.
They never would find you there.
Why, you wouldn't even know where to start hunting somebody.
Sutri looked at Harrogate and shook his head.
How far you reckon it is to town? Said Harrogate.
It's 6 or 8 miles. Listen, if you've got to run off, why don't you wait and slip off from the county garage some evening?
What for?
Hell, you're practically in town. Besides, it would be dark or damn near it.
Harrogate paused from his chewing, his eyes fixed on his shoe. Then he commenced chewing again.
You might be right, he said.
Sutri was unwrapping his other sandwich.
It don't make all that much difference, actually, he said.
Why's that?
Because they'll catch your skinny ass anyway.
There ain't no way.
What do you aim to do about clothes? What do you think people are going to say when they see you wandering around in that outfit?
I'll get me some clothes first thing.
Sutri shook his head.
Hell, Sud, I can slip around.
Gene.
Yeah?
You look wrong. You will always look wrong.
Harrogate looked at the floor. He had stopped chewing.
No, I won't, he said.
The weather turned colder, and they did not go out. Wilson put Harrogate to work painting the black borders along the lower hallway walls that served for baseboards. The workhouse smelled of paint, and so did the country mouse when he came up in the evening with the smears of black on his face, like a guerrilla fighter. One night, Sutri said to him,
Don't you have any family?
The lights were out. A few bodies shifted in the dark.
Don't you?
Said the small voice overhead. Christmas came, and some of the married prisoners were furloughed home to holiday with their families. A few were released. Slusser came from solitary, the pick still on his leg. He entered with his blanket and went down the aisle without speaking to anyone. There was a lighted tree in the recreation room downstairs, and on Christmas Day they had turkey with all the trimmings. Callahan in the kitchen, drunk, making pumpkin pies out of old sweet potatoes and carrots. Sots, loose from the drunk tank, wandering about crazed with thirst. An air of wary joy, like Christmas in some Arctic outpost. The following day was Sunday. Sutri was playing poker when his name was called. He played on.
That's you, Sutri.
He folded his cards. He glanced toward the door and rose heavily, handing the cards down to Harrogate.
Don't lose all my money, he said.
The hall guard opened the door, and he went out and down the stairs. The mess hall was filled with families, enormous baskets of fruit, country people, some bewildered, some in tears, old men who had been here themselves, perhaps.
Over yonder, said Blackburn.
She was sitting at the table at the far end of the hall, quietly in her good clothes. He turned to go back, but Blackburn gripped him by his sleeve and pulled him around. "You get your ass over there," he said. He made his way along the edge of the table. She had her purse in her lap, and she was looking down. She was still wearing her hat from church. He sat down on the bench across the table from her, and she looked up at him. She looked old. He could not remember her looking so. Her slack and pleated throat, the flesh beneath her jaws, her eyes paler. "Hello, Mother," he said. Her lower chin began to dimple and quiver.
"Buddy," she said. "Buddy."
But the son she addressed was hardly there at all. Numbly, he watched himself fold his hands on the table. He heard his voice, remote, adrift. "Please don't start crying," he said. See the hand that nursed the serpent, the fine hasped pipes of her finger bones, the skin bewenned and speckled. The veins are milk blue and bulby, a thin gold ring set with diamonds. That raised the once child's heart of her to agonies of passion before I was. Here is the anguish of mortality, hopes wrecked, love sundered. See the mother sorrowing, how everything that I was warned of's come to pass. Sutri began to cry, nor could he stop it. People were looking. He rose. The room swam.
"Buddy," she said. "Buddy."
"I can't," he said. Hot salt strangled him. He wheeled away. Blackburn would have stopped him at the door, but when he saw his face, he let him go. Sutri jerked his arm away and went through the gate and up the stairs. He was released a few days later on order from Judge Kelly. The country mouse had run off from a work detail the morning before, and as Sutri came from the supply room dressed in the clothes he'd worn through the slam 7 months earlier, Harrogate was being led clumping along the hall with a pick on his leg. They exchanged glances as they passed, but you couldn't say it in words. Sutri was taken back to town in the same car that had brought him out. It was snowing, but the roads were clear. He woke in the logy heat of full summer noon, with the sun beating on the tin roof above him and raising a sour smell out of the old wood of the cabin. He could hear the howl of the saws in the lumber mill across the river, and he could hear the intermittent scream of swine come under the knacker's hand at the packing company. He turned his face to the wall and opened one eye, watched through a split in the sun-riven boards the slow brown neap of the passing river. After a while, he struggled up, blinking in the dusty slats of sunlight that sliced through the hot murk. He tottered erect onto the floor in the trousers he'd slept in and made his way to the door and stepped out, scratching his naked belly, watching the boards for stray fishhooks as he went barefoot toward the rail. He leaned on his elbows and looked out over the river. The skiff had sunk to the gunwales and lay quietly awash in the current. He propped up one foot and studied his toes. He could hear everywhere in the hot summer air the drone of machinery, the lonely industry of the city. He blinked and stretched. A gravel dredger was moving upriver, her pipes and tackle slung up in the trucks. He watched it pass. A figure on the pilot deck waved, and he waved back. Sutri took the rope loose from the rail and began to haul the skiff along the side of the houseboat. It yawed and wallowed in the river. He threw the rope ashore and went down the plank and retrieved it from the mud, and miring to his ankle bones, he eased the skiff in. He got hold of the ring in the prow and braced himself and lifted. Mud spurted between his toes. He hoisted the front of the skiff and watched the water sluice heavily over the transom into the river. Tails flared and subsided. He hauled the skiff partly up the bank and lifted it sideways. The trapped fish milled and surged. He tilted with care, their shapes riding up along the overflow and dropping back again. When he lowered the skiff, they lay gaping on the boards under a sun that withered them visibly. Sutri gripped his fore pockets, searching. He rose and went to the shanty and returned with a large clasp knife. He reached into the bottom of the boat and brought up a catfish by the lower jaw. It quivered slightly and curled its tail. Sutri turned it and sank the point of his knife into its throat and opened its wet and pale blue belly with a clean slicing motion that dumped forth the living viscera down his forearm in a welter of dark blood. He seized these entrails and hauled them from the fish and slung them, a wet analoid mass writhing brightly in the sun, and dropping through the placid face of the river with a light splash that sucked away almost at once. He laid the cleaned fish by and seized the next. They were seven in all, and he had them dressed in minutes and aligned in the shade under the skiff's seat. He cut the leaders from the hooks he'd salvaged, and he rinsed the blood and mucus from his hands and cleaned the knife and folded the blade away and returned to the shanty. When he came out again, he wore a shirt loosely unbuttoned, and he had a towel over one shoulder, and he carried a small porcelain basin and a leather shaving bag. He came down the plank walk and went across the field toward the warehouse, still barefoot and stepping carefully, emerging onto the rail bed and walking three tentative steps on the hot steel before hopping off again. He did a little hot foot dance and went on among the cinders and rough ties. Passing through a landscape of old tires and cast-off water tanks rusting in the weeds and bottomless buckets and broken slabs of concrete. When he left the roadbed, he turned up along the side of the warehouse, the new tin brightly galvanized and reeling in the enormous heat, and his shadow wincing blackly across the corrugated glare of it like a crepe paper player in a shadow show. At the far end of the warehouse was a brass spigot. Beneath it, the cracked red clay lay shaped in a basin centered by a dark, ochreous eye where the water dripped. Sutri knelt and laid out his things, hung his small mirror from a nail, set his wash basin under the tap, and turned on the water. Squinting, he inspected his beard, testing the water idly with one finger. It came hot from the tap in this weather, and he laved a palmful over his cheeks and wet his brush and lathered carefully. Then he opened his razor and stropped it briefly on the side of his shaving bag and commenced to shave, pulling the skin taut with his fingers. When he was finished, he flung away the water in a beaded explosion of vapor under the scorching wall of the warehouse, a brief rainbow. He filled the basin again and took off his shirt and splashed himself wet and soaped and rinsed and dried himself with the towel. He put away the razor and brushed his teeth, squatting on his heels there in the raw clay, looking about. A hot silence hung over the riverfront. Over the stained and leaning clapboard shacks, over the barren rubble lots and the fields of wire-colored sedge, over the cratered wastes of hardpan and the railway road. And silence among these broiling colossi of tin and down by the stones and bracken and mud that mark the river shore. Something that looked like a mouse, save it had no tail, came out of the weeds below him, and crossed the open like a wind-up toy and scuttled from sight beneath the warehouse wall. Sutri spat and rinsed his mouth. A black witch known as Mother She was going along Front Street toward the store, a frail bent shape in black partlet with cane laboring brokenly through the heat. He rose and collected his things and went back down the dry clay gutter by the edge of the warehouse and along the tracks and across the fields. As he neared the shanty, he saw a long gray cat struggling toward the weeds, towing its own length of fish. He shouted and waved at it. He scooped and shied a rock, hobbling along ginger-footed through the stubble. When he came up, the cat squared off at him, a starved and snarling thing with the hackles reared along its razorous spine. It did not let go the fish. Sutri threw a rock at it. The cat's ears lay flat along its head, and its tail kept jerking. He threw another rock that caromed off its stark ribs. It dropped the fish and yowled at him, still crouched there, cocked on its bony elbows. "Why, goddamn you," said Sutri. He cast about until he found a huge clod of dried mud, and going close, he broke it over the animal. It squalled and scrabbled away, shaking its head. Sutri retrieved the fish and looked it over. He rinsed it in the river and gathered up the other fish and piled them in his wash basin, a tottery load, and went on to the shanty. The cat was already back in the skiff, searching. With the day's sun full on the tin roof, the heat in the houseboat was unendurable. He put away his things and got a clean shirt and trousers from his cardboard bureau, and dressed and took his shoes and socks and towel and went out onto the deck. There he sat looking out through the rails with his feet hanging in the river. Down near the bridge, an old man pulled a skiff by the shore, standing precarious and daring, wielding a long-handled hook. A fellow worker in these cloacal reaches, plying the trade he has devised for himself. The old man's name was Magason, and Sutri smiled to see him at his work, going slow, shaded by the fronds of a huge and raveled fiber hat brim. He dried his feet and put on his socks and shoes and combed his hair. Inside the shanty, he wrapped the fish in a newspaper and tied them with a string and took the coal oil can from its corner. At the door, he looked to see had he forgotten anything, and then he left. When he reached the street, he walked along until he found a flat place at the paving's edge and under the weeds, and here he stopped and poured the kerosene over the warm tar. Then he set the can from sight in the weeds and went on. Gravely, gravely, small chocolate children nodded or lifted pale brown palms. Hello.
Heidi.
He climbed up from the river and went toward the city with his fish. Early in his living by the river, Sutri had found a shortcut through old gardens on the river bluff, a winding path with cinder paving that angled up behind old homes of blackened boarding and old porches where rusted skeins of screening fell down the rotting facades. But passing under one high window, always he heard a dull mutter of invective and sullen oaths, and he no longer took the near path, but went the longer way round by the streets. The invector, however, had moved to a new window, so large was the house that he shared with his soul, and he could still watch for the fisherman to pass. In these later years he had become confined altogether, and this was hard for one accustomed to tottering daily abroad and dripping vitriol on passing strangers. He keeps his watch with fidelity, an old man dimly seen in upper window corners. Market Street on Monday morning, Knoxville, Tennessee. In this year, 1951. Sutri, with his parcel of fish going past the rows of derelict trucks, piled with produce and flowers, an atmosphere rank with country commerce, a reek of farm goods in the air, tending off into a light surmise of putrefaction and decay. Pariahs adorned the walk, and blind singers and organists and psalmists with mouth harps wandered up and down. Past hardware stores and meat markets and little tobacco shops. A strong smell of feed in the hot noon like working mash. Mute and roosting peddlers watching from their wagon beds, and flower ladies in their bonnets like cowled gnomes, driftwood hands composed in their apron laps and their underlips swollen with snuff. He went among vendors and beggars and wild street preachers, haranguing a lost world with a vigor unknown to the sane. Sutri admired them with their hot eyes and dog-eared Bibles, God's barkers gone forth into the world like the prophets of old. He'd often stood along the edges of the crowd for some stray scrap of news from beyond the pale. He crossed the street, stepping gutters clogged with green stuff. Coming from behind the trucks, a beggar lady's splotched and marcid arm barred his way, a palsied claw that gibbered at his chest. He slid past, stale nun-like smell of her clothes, dry flesh within. The old armstress's eyes floated by in a mist of bitterness, but he had nothing but his fish. He passed under the shade of the market house, where brick the color of dried blood rose turreted and cupolaed and crazed into the heat of the day, form on form in demented accretion without precedent or counterpart in the annals of architecture. Pigeons bobbed and preened in the high barbicans or shat from the blackened parapets. Sutri pushed through the gray doors below.